Yeah, baby, it's episode 143 on March 12th, 2024. The lightning round of Ask the Inspector. We do it every Tuesday for 1 hour. Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. And normally we have Yelena helping us out backstage, but today she is missing. I hope she's okay. I haven't heard from her. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing well, thanks. Yourself?
Well, considering I have to do this alone, I'm just fine. I will cope.
Rumor has it you have a new desk, though.
Yes, that is true. And that necessitated me disassembling everything. And so I barely got it all back together again. And as usual, whenever I unhook things from the computer, it doesn't work right away. But we got it working, I think. So that part is good. However, I wasn't able to publish the new Substack. Later today or this evening, we will publish it. This is as far as we got. Scott Ritter and the Russian Path of Redemption. This is part three in a three-part series, The Bittersweet Birth of New Russia. And what are the readers going to see in this when they go to scottritterextra.com?
Well, what they're going to find out is it's actually part three in a four-part series because I envisioned writing about the new territories, Kherson, Zaporizhia, and Donetsk and Luhansk in one swoop, but it became apparent that it was too long. And so I broke it up into two. So now it's a four-part series. So this part talks about Kherson and Zaporizhia and traveling there and meeting with the governor of Kherson and talking about the problems that he faces and just talking about the new territories in general. I mean, the Russian identity that's attached to them historically, and the problems they have in maintaining and sustaining that identity. One of the interesting facts in talking to the governor of Kherson is that the population of that region shrank by over 60%, with many people leaving, going to Ukraine, saying they don't want to be part of what they call a Russian occupation, and other people's just fleeing to Russia, saying they don't want to live in a war zone. And so now you have a territory that has been absorbed by Russia. And in order to survive, the governor is going to have to find a way to regain the confidence of the people and the viability of Kherson as a territory. And Maverick clearly, it feels the pain of the people of Kherson. And the same holds for Zaporizhia. So these are two territories that our frontline territories, they're active war zones. They see diminished populations. And in order to, once this war ends, there will be a real challenge in, bringing people back home or having new people come to these territories and making them part of Russia. But in talking with the governor, Vladimir Saldo, of Kherson and the people that he works with, it's, I'm confident that they'll be able to do this job, but I also want to emphasize that this is not an easy job. It's a very difficult road ahead for these people, but it's an important part of the Russia's path of redemption in this area of the world.
All right, so you can read it at scottritterextra.com. This is part three in a four-part series. Was it originally planned as four parts, and I forgot that, or you decided to add a fourth installment?
No, it was originally planned as three parts. First part was the Chechen miracle, which I felt was important to talk about when we speak of projecting forward. Then the second part was about Crimea. And the third part was supposed to be about the four new territories. But in talking about, first of all, I realized that there's the two distinct personalities there, that the Kherson and Zaporizhia are not the same as Donetsk and Luhansk, both in terms of their historical development and in terms of where they are today. And I also realized I was having two different conversations in Kherson and Zaporizhia and in Donetsk and Luhansk. And that, as I wrote this, I realized that if I, If I try and squeeze it all into one article, I'll be doing a disservice to both topics. And if I make it one complete article, it'll just be too long. So I went ahead and cut it. And the next article, which is nearly finished, basically starts with me crossing into Donetsk.
That's the beauty of not having a boss, right? I mean, you don't have to worry about deadlines. You don't have to worry about particular space limitations or anything like that.
Plenty of bosses. I'm talking to one of them right now who always reminds me that I need product. I need here. You have to be here on time. You're right. In a way, it's not.
It's all relative. It's all relative. Now, come on.
It's all relative, but to imply that I don't feel pressure. I mean, I feel nothing but pressure, and I don't mean it in a bad way, but there's a duty to respond, and I have many different
but there's flexibility. there's flexibility as to the format and the duration and so forth. In the days, all very corporate, and you had to fit into very specific time blocks and all that kind of stuff. You know?
No, at the end of the day, I get to make the executive decisions about, what gets done, et cetera, but it doesn't mean that the pressure's not on. I mean, not that, but for instance, I'm running, this Navalny thing. The rewrite is a significant task with significant, which requires significant, allocation of time. And time is a precious commodity. And, I'm running, for instance, tomorrow I get on a train to Washington, D.C. Now I'm going to try and work on the train, make it productive time, but I begin a week-long travel that takes me to many places, including Wilmington, North Carolina, where I get to watch Bob Dylan perform live on Monday. But I'm also going to Tampa, Florida. I'm also going to Chapel Hill. And the time that would normally be available to do certain projects isn't there. So whereas I wanted Navalny Part 2 to be done by now, it's now gone back. And then what happens is, I'm just trying to explain it to people. Then what happens is other projects, like I have to finish this. We got Roger Waters to graciously allow us to use Two Suns in the Sunset in our movie Waging Peace. But that means we have a song for our trailer, but I have to nail down that trailer stuff. And while I'm nailing down the trailer stuff, then I have Clarity Press calling me about a book, and I'm supposed to get an outline into them. And so there's a pressure. And then I have Consortium News saying, where's the article you promised for us? And RT saying, where's the article you promised for us? And I'm looking at the calendar. So what happens is I have all these pieces and I have to prioritize them. And that damn Navalny article keeps getting put into the rear of the queue, but I will get it done. I promise.
All right. Well, I don't think anybody was feeling otherwise. And luckily, luckily you're a master of time management.
Well, no, thank you for the vote of confidence, but just talk to Marina. She'll say, no, he's not.
All right. Well, maybe I meant that more aspirationally than in reality.
Yes, I aspire to be a master.
All right, let's get to the questions. This is the lightning round. Scott will answer every question in 3 minutes or less. The first comes from Alan in Portugal. Today, there were ground attacks deep in Russian territory following the announcement of joint drills of the Russian, Chinese, and Iranian navies near the Persian Gulf. There was also significant escalation in the past 2 days in Lebanon and Yemen. Your thoughts on recent developments and the possibility of World War III, considering that Europe is in dire economic straits and is physically incapable of supporting the industrial effort required for war?
Well, Alan, that's a very complicated question with a lot of data thrown together, some of which is related to the others, other which have no relation. For instance, one, there weren't deep ground attacks. I don't know where you came up with it. I know you're referring to the attacks carried out by anti-Putin Russian elements working for Ukrainian intelligence that attacked in the Belgorod and Kerch directions. My understanding is that these barely got to the border before they were destroyed, and that they've all been pushed back, and that the Ukrainians have suffered, or these anti-Putin Russians working for the Ukrainians have suffered extraordinarily heavy losses. you know, this is something that's been happening in the past. It's going to happen again until this conflict is over. It's an effort for a propaganda victory by Ukraine to have these anti-Putin elements go in, especially on the eve of a Russian election, and take selfies in front of a Russian village, and then broadcast that somehow Russia can't control its borders. I think the evidence shows that Russia can, in fact, control its borders, and it defeated these people. And there, it was, end of that. There's no relationship between that and this joint naval drill by Russia, China, and Iran. The drill has been planned for a long time. These things don't happen overnight. They announced this drill, late or early last year. So there's nothing new there. There's no significance to be read into that, other than that Russia, China, and Iran now are acting out on aspirations of, joint regional interest. The desire to coordinate on, naval drills, et cetera, that, I think China and Russia are saying this area of the world is important to us. But it does, there's no treaty alliance. It doesn't mean that the Russian Navy sailing to the Iranian Navy's rescue, or China's coming to Iran's rescue if there is a conflict between Iran and the United States. We're not there yet. The escalations in Lebanon and Yemen are, I forgot about the clock. The escalations in Iran and Yemen are purely related to, local things, not global things. And NATO's in no position to go to war with Russia. It's not just your collapsed economy and a lack of industrial base. You have no military capacity to go to war with Russia. So I'm not worried about World War III. And from all that, I will say that, we still have to be careful of any inadvertent conflict between Russia and NATO, because that could lead to a nuclear exchange, and that would be very problematic for humanity.
All right. Good job, Scott. It was a very complicated question. I even had to reduce the font size to fit it all in.
I saw I was squinting. I was like, yeah. Jeff, what are you doing?
Well, I thought since it was like an up to the minute question, I thought I would put it in there. Now, so one of the comments said, did you see what happened to the Rumble stock today? Well, no, I didn't. What happened? I'm very interested in the progress of Rumble. They, of course, are way behind YouTube technologically, but since they're the free speech haven for us, I'm rooting for them every step of the way. So if you want to give me another comment.
Since we put all our Bitcoin into Rumble.
Well, if it sounds like maybe the stock went way up today, so I guess it's too late to buy, but I don't know. So let me know what happened. Next question is from Ian in Canada. Why do you think that Russian ships in the Black Sea seem to be so vulnerable to unmanned boats? Does Russia not have the ability to effectively counter these drones or their source?
Well, I think the obvious answer to the second part of the question is Russia doesn't appear to have the ability to effectively defend against this. These boats continue to get through. It's a non-traditional mechanism of attack that Russia clearly hasn't adapted to. these boats are able to approach, avoiding detection. I don't know if that's because the U.S. intelligence or whatever is helping them, navigate the route. For whatever reason, they're able to get into vicinity of the boat of their targets and then to attack them, and attack them multiple times and inflicting oftentimes fatal damage. So there it is. It's interesting, though. For instance, if you take the Su-57, Russia has built drones that accompany this. And so basically they take a valuable aerial target and they create drones around it that help protect it. When you look at, other things that Russia does on the ground, they have drones that protect, et cetera. One would think that Russia could come up with its own drones that operate from a ship. For instance, when it's at anchor, you could deploy tethered drones around the ship that are actively scanning and interdicting any thing that comes in. I mean, it's not a wild idea. I don't know why Russia hasn't come up with something like that, because clearly what they're doing right now isn't working. These other drones, they're less likely to hit a moving target. So if the Russian Navy is out at in the Black Sea maneuvering, these drones probably aren't going to be as effective. They tend to strike in a protected harbor, in a harbor area where the target is stationary, and they're able to swarm in and do it. But if you meet their swarm with a defensive swarm, you might be able to beat it. I mean, look, for all the guys out there in Sukhoi or anybody who does this, if you act on my idea, make sure that Jeff gets a percentage of your profits.
Okay. I want to make some profit on the Rumble stock too. According to, I think it was Paul West, it went up $1.42. Is that considered a lot? Are you a stock market guy, Scott?
If I was a stock market guy, I'd either be out on the street homeless or I'd be living in a mansion. No, I don't.
Well, I'm not either. In fact, I've never bought any stocks my whole life, and I don't have very much money now, but I was thinking of maybe, just because I'm into the whole Rumble thing, buying a small amount.
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know what its price was before. It says it went up 21%. Yeah. It's still a very cheap stock. And so if it's going up 21%, at this low of a price, I would imagine that, it's showing pretty good growth potential and somebody's believing in that growth. And so if you have the money to invest, I couldn't see how you could go wrong. Now you're going to invest and it's going to collapse and you're going to look at me and say, what the hell? And I'll say, that's why I don't invest in stocks. But
all right, we have to issue a disclaimer. That is not advice, correct?
Well, I can't give advice to anybody about stocks.
All right. I'm just accustomed to seeing people give that disclaimer. So anyway, all right.
Oh, no, I'm not even pretending to be a stock. I said right up front, if you probably go bankrupt if you listen to me. I'm not a stock guy.
All right. If anybody is a stock expert, try to succinctly put it in the comments what we need to know to proceed. Vishal Jadhav in Navi Mumbai, India. Could we experience a USS Liberty type of scenario if the Israelis consider the temporary port built by the U.S. a viable threat? Could that pier be a ruse to fortify U.S. intelligence in Gaza?
No, I don't think Israel would attack the U.S. port. If they did, I think we would blow the living crap out of Israel. We're not going to tolerate that. The USS Liberty was a one-of situation in 1967. It's not going to happen again. It just simply won't happen again. So no, Israel isn't going to attack this pier. Using that pier to collect intelligence is unnecessary and unduly risky and stupid. I would use it as an intelligence collection platform. There's existing platforms that can be used. First of all, we have an ongoing relationship with the Israelis that give us access to, platforms in Gaza and out of Gaza that position us to be, for us to be better positioned to collect intelligence information. So using the pier would be extraordinarily stupid. So there's that.
All right. I think there is about 50 veterans still alive who are on the USS Liberty.
Yeah.
30 some odd of them got murdered. A bunch of others were severely injured when they were attacked by Israel, and they feel they never got due process. And we're going to interview Friday night a special guest. His name is Phil Turney. He is the president of the USS Liberty Veterans Association. And so we're going to hear how he feels, why he feels that they never got due process. So join us Friday night and our usual time, 8 p.m., for Ask the Inspector, the loquacious version. And let me try to stop that clock. There we go. Naiz in Malaysia. Israel built a motorway across Gaza separating the North Strip from the rest, and they're planning to build more. How did they manage to do it, given resistance forces are still active across the whole strip?
Well, first of all, how did they manage to do it? It's a very select zone. They probably picked an area where there's very little urban buildup, so there's very little cover for Hamas resistance to operate from. My guess is that during this attack, during this construction, that there was attacks. In fact, as I know for a fact, there was attack on Israeli crews, the bulldozers, etc., by Hamas. But again, it's a difficult place to operate from. Once you pop up from your tunnel and you engage, you've lost that tunnel. And there's only a finite number of tunnels. And I think at this juncture, Hamas, you know, realized that it's better to preserve, you know, their assets for bigger things. At the end of the day, Israel is going to have to withdraw from Gaza. So thank you, Israel, for building a road for the future Gazan government to use. But I just think that Hamas said it's better to take these resources and use them in the north, use them in Khan Yunis, keep them down in Rafah, but not to put them at risk taking out Israeli, you know, equipment that at the end of the day, you're not going to stop the Israelis from building this road. So I just think they, you know, they did some stuff to interdict, but it's not worth the risk gain analysis doesn't pay out in favor of keeping to do that. You preserve whatever resources you can for whatever you need to do.
All right. According to Paul West, the Rumble stock is up on news that Rumble is interested in buying TikTok.
That's an interesting purchase, given that everybody in the world seems to be, in America, seems to be opposed to TikTok, except the president uses it in a campaign, and every other kid in America. TikTok is I don't use it, but I, you know, on X, and you know this, when you on any social media platform, there's these very clever TikTok videos, and they're used for a variety of purposes, to inform, to entertain, etc. It's an absolutely wonderful application if used properly. And, you know, we're trying, you know, we have people saying you can't have it because it gives the Chinese the ability to collect. I don't ever want to hear an American. I don't ever want to hear an American, especially an American government official, talking about, you know, if you say TikTok is for children, you have no clue what TikTok is, Steely Dan. You really don't know what TikTok is nowadays, because it's gone well beyond that. It's used very effectively to create very informative, you know, clips on a variety of issues. Yeah, I agree. Initially, it was something the kids, I mean, you know, you'd see that, you know, people would do stupid TikTok tricks or whatever, but it's beyond that today. It's a very effective, it's like when tweeting started, everybody made fun of Twitter, you know, how can you communicate in 146 characters? Well, you can't, that's why they went to 240. But, you know, the bottom line though is you master that, even 146, you master the ability to get short, ideas across. And then there's the whole threading that can done. And suddenly Twitter became one of the dominant, I believe, you know, platform for getting ideas across. TikTok started out as something that was, you know, childlike and entertaining. It's maturing to a very, very effective, a visual communication means. And,
from all that, Scott, the concern, and I don't buy it, but the concern is that, or the claim is that, China, it's a security threat because China is collecting data on Americans. It's operated by the
Communist Party. There's no evidence of that whatsoever. There's no evidence whatsoever. Plus, again, for an American to say this, shut up.
Yeah, right,
we collect intelligence on the entire world using everything from a Samsung TV. All those Samsung TVs you buy, America, understand the NSA can tap in anytime they want and watch your family. And everything you do is sucked up by the United States. So shut the up about collection. We have no evidence China's doing it, but we know what America's doing. And for America to sit there and say, you know why? Because America doesn't control TikTok. Now, if somebody buys TikTok, an American company, then we'll be feel happy.
Right. Yeah. They want to have Facebook control the election. And so Facebook loses influence the more anybody else has influence.
Right.
I think what you said is spot on, Scott, and it's probably best for folks to just assume that privacy really isn't a thing. There is no privacy.
Not anymore, man. Not anymore. It's really not.
Luckily, we have nothing to hide. I don't know about
it. Trust me, if the U.S. government wants to spend time watching little old me putter around my house, have at it, guys. I take 60 FBI agents off important tasks and they can sit there and say, damn, he's just getting fatter and slower.
Pavel in Vladivostok, Russia. On March 15, 16, and 17, presidential elections are being held in Russia. Maybe it's time to tell your audience about the Russian voting system. What do you think, Scott? Is it time?
One, I don't care. It's a Russian problem. You run your own elections. I don't care. I don't care what you do in Russia. It's your issue. It's your problem. You know, who the hell am I or anybody else to explain what a Russian election system is or this? Russia has elections. I will tell you this. All votes will be counted at the end of the election period, and they'll have a defined winner at the end of the election period. And most people will say that it was a free, fair election. There will always be the snipers out there that pick on it, et cetera. But, the, you know, a Russia has an election process. It works. They produce a winner at the end that, you know, nobody can question that. They can say, well, you know, Navalny, you know, couldn't get on it, or this person couldn't get on it. But that's not about the election system. That's about the fact that Navalny was a CIA asset. And no nation is going to let an asset of a foreign intelligence service on and run. But Russia runs its own elections. Why do you want an American to explain that? Pavel, you live in Vladivostok. Why don't you explain it to the American audience? That would be a better way to go about this issue.
Well, Scott, not to be argumentative, but he doesn't have a podcast. You're the inspector, and that's who we have. So you've
well, very the better way to do it, Pavel, is to say the Russian election process consists of A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. What do you think about that? That way you've defined it, but you want me? No, I'm not. My business isn't to get it. No, but Jeff, come on, man. Work with me on this one. It's not our job to tell Russians about their election system.
Well, it's not our job to criticize them, but I mean, if to the extent you might know, maybe educate the Americans.
But I don't think that's the intent of the question.
No, you didn't like the attitude. You detected a little bit of attitude there, did you?
Could be.
Yeah. All right. Maybe so. All right. Let me try to get rid of this comment. I'm doing 10 things at once.
Well, you left Jeff, it up there long enough. Somebody might think you agree with
me. I know, but they keep flying by, and then I hit the wrong one when it's moving. It's very difficult. I have a whole new appreciation for what Yelena and Ann does now, although they don't have to host the show at the same time. So anyway, who is John Boyd, and in what way did his work affect the United States Air Force's organizational and power protection capabilities, if at all? Are you doing calisthenics? I didn't know if you were doing it because of the question or it's just a coincidence. It
is. I love the question.
Look at how happy you are.
Well, John Boyd's the man. He's the OODA loop. John Boyd.
If you're happy about that, you might be happy that I anticipated you would get happy. And there it is, the OODA loop.
Look at you. But you've made the OODA loop complicated. The OODA loop's never meant to be this complicated. The beauty of the OODA loop is that it's simple. It's observation, orientation, decision, action. John Boyd was an American fighter pilot. And I forget what it was, 30-second Boyd or 1-minute Boyd or 3-minute Boyd. I forget what time frame he put on his name. But the bottom line is he said, I will go nose to nose with it. That means two aircraft, you're going to fly and you're going to go by each other. And the second you go past each other, the dogfight begins. And he says, once that happens, I own you. I will shoot you down in a certain period of time. It might be 3 minutes, 30 seconds. I don't know. But basically, what he's saying is the reason why he's going to win is that he's going to get inside your decision-making cycle. He has studied you. He knows the aircraft. He knows the characteristics of your airplanes. He knows how. And so when he comes in, he's going to do something. He's going to act. The key is that you have to act first. You act and you get somebody to react to you. Then once they react, you observe, you orient, you observe, then you make a decision to do this. And then he has to react to you. And after a certain amount of turns, he's going to be behind you and he's going to shoot you down. And so basically it was an approach to, fighter pilot. But then what happened is, it became, look, the reason why I know it so well is that in the 1980s, the Marine Corps adopted John Boyd's theory, the OODA loop, to use it for maneuver warfare. And basically what we said is we're tired of, God, I only got a minute and 20, damn it. We're tired of going over to the beach and getting slaughtered. Because the Marine Corps approach used to be, hey, did a little straight up the middle. I mean, yeah, we were good. We were well-trained, all that. But what made us succeed is that we just didn't give a flying F. And we went in and we waded through Tarawa, get machine gunned down. Guys came in, they charged up, got machine gunned down, kept going until they bayoneted everybody to death, and they won. Suribachi, they landed on, got blown up, went up, got shot up, boom, 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 killed everybody, and they won. And we said, you know, we're tired of building monuments. So instead, we're going to get smarter maneuver warfare. We adopted the OODA loop to create maneuver warfare, and it's gone into strategic thinking. They're using it in leadership, et cetera. And basically, the goal is to get inside your enemy's decision-making cycle. Once you're inside that, to get inside their OODA loop, you're inevitably going to win. John Boyd is somebody everybody should study. The OODA loop is a bit of genius.
All right, you got to pronounce that D very clearly. Otherwise, it sounds like John Boy from the Waltons. John Ooh. Boy. No, you were fine, but I kind of half heard that. Let's take a phone call. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector on the lightning round. What's your question?
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I was glad I could get a hold of you. Very, very much enjoyed the show. My question for Scott is, a lot of the critique that you hear levied, especially towards places like China and Russia, but even sometimes what I hear towards Iran, is that if at any time when the American empire does start to recede, the biggest critique for supporting a lot of these countries is that essentially you're supporting the next empire. You're supporting the next country that will be exploiting and extracting resources. And my response to that, and what I wanted Scott to comment and see if he agrees and to elaborate more if possible, is that these countries, especially China and Iran in particular, and even Russia to an extent, are systematically going about arming and giving the countries the material conditions to not allow exploitation and empire to be done at the extent that America, for instance, has done it, or British have done it in the past. And so my biggest critique is, or, you know, response to that is that they are giving these other countries, these smaller countries, these historically exploited, perfect example being the Houthis, the ability to fight off whatever, you know, future empire might want to come in and take their resources. And I was wondering if Scott could comment on that and if he agrees with that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, first of all, one of the issues with the way that question, and I'm not blaming you, I'm just talking about the way the question's phrased and the what seems to be the genesis of the question, is there's an assumption that, you know, the world is like us. You know, right now there's the American empire, and the job of this American empire is to suck the life out of global resources to our benefit. And so there's an assumption that when we fall, whoever replaces us is automatically could be inclined to suck the life resources out of the world to their benefit. But the three nations that you named, Russia, China, and Iran, one thing that they all have in common is that they have been subjected to American sanctions. And so they, you know, by making themselves sanction proof, they block the America's ability to suck resources out, et cetera. They've also developed economic systems that are designed in a different mindset. So, you know, and then the other thing you have to understand is that nobody out there is saying, hey, we can't wait for Rome to fall so we become the new Rome. Everybody's saying, we don't believe in a new Rome. We want multipolarity. And, you know, Russia, China, and Iran have all bought into that. They're part of the BRICS. They're part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, two entities that have embraced multipolarity as their model of operation. And so I don't think the world has anything to fear. And again, I'm not somebody who believes, I don't think that, K-bar, I like that. Sorry, I saw a Marine Corps knife, and so I got distracted. But it's like a cat with a laser beam, K-bar. Where was I? These three nations are not about, nobody's saying that they want to replace the United States. Nobody's saying they want a new hegemony. They're all talking about multipolarity and working together. If anything, they're talking about, I forgot Turkey. About what? How did I forget Turkey? I don't understand where that came in from. Turkey was never part of the question. Therefore, it's not part of the answer. Anyways, I think I've answered that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you didn't mention that weren't particularly related to the show.
I didn't mention Brazil, Argentina. Yeah, right.
All right. Let's see the next question. Let me stop the clock there. Hang on.
83 Zulu. That is an MOS. I should look it up sometime, see what it is.
All right. Sarah Allard from the Netherlands. Sweden has now joined NATO. Did Turkey, or Turkey, as some are wont to say, get its demands for Sweden to expel all the Swedish parliamentarians from parliament who supported the Kurds and the burning of the Quran?
And the answer is no. Turkey didn't get its way at all, but what Turkey got were F-16s. That was the bribe. This was always a game from K-Bar Submarine is a meaty bonus to Maverick. Sorry, I can't stop reading the comments, but I told you, K-Bar is like a laser beam. Stop it, people. But the Turkey, Erdogan, you know, I had a Russian actually talk to me about Erdogan, and I was like, why aren't you guys really angry at this guy because he, you know, does things that seems to be betrayal of you? And they say, look, Turkey is a sovereign nation. Turkey has a whole host of issues that Turkey is responsible for solving, not Russia. And Erdogan is the Turkish leader, and he has to go out and solve these problems. And he's going to solve them the way he does. And we have to respect that. We don't have to be happy with what he does, but we have to respect that Erdogan's number one priority is Turkey. And so, you know, for a lot of people, myself included, you know, you're sort of rooting that Turkey's going to block Sweden from going into NATO and all that stuff. Except that we forgot that Turkey's motivation isn't to weaken NATO. Turkey's motivation is to strengthen Turkey, And Erdogan on that standpoint deserves to get all the credit in the world for getting the F-16s. Yusuf, I don't agree that Turkey will soon exit NATO because what's going to replace that? I mean, for Turkey to exit NATO, there has to be something for Turkey to step into. Maybe if Turkey becomes a member of BRICS, and there's rumors that Turkey may put an application in for that, and Turkey joins the Shanghai, how does I keep all my hair? I don't know. Shanghai Cooperation Organization, you know, now they'll have a framework of institutions that it can fall into that give it the same support that it gets right now from NATO and indirectly, even though it's not a member of the European Union, by being a quasi member of the European community where they coordinate on policy and all that stuff. That's important structural infrastructure there that Turkey fits into right now. For Turkey to leave is like me going to the top of the Empire State Building and stepping off, and I don't have a parachute. So I'm going to hit the ground and die. Turkey's not in the business of committing suicide. So, you know, before Turkey leaves NATO, there has to be something that's going to replace the benefits that Turkey gets, and they are many benefits from NATO and European Association, American friendship. They need something to replace that. Right now, nothing like that exists.
Not only does Scott still have all his hair, but there's almost no gray hairs, and I'm very jealous.
It's getting there, though. I'm getting that little salt and pepper kind of stuff right now.
Very depressing to me.
I'm starting to look my age.
No. You still look about 20 years younger than you are. Yeah. Chuck in Chicago. I'm pretty convinced at this point they opened the border to build the military to fight the upcoming war because, let's be honest, Americans aren't in fighting shape. With that in mind, is it really a bad idea? Because I see no other options if war is inevitable.
Well, Chuck, I sort of like this idea. I mean, now, God, I'm going to get in trouble because I'm making a joke and I can't make a joke about these. But the idea of how old am I? I'm 62 years old. The idea is, if you take men of military age, and you start somewhere in Central America, and you have to force march through rough terrain and difficult situations, avoiding patrols and all that. And by the time you make it across the Rio Grande, you've done one hell of a selection operation. And you cross in, I'm going, you're qualified. So you're in good physical condition. You've shown that you can handle stress. We're bringing in the military. So facetiously speaking, I mean, it makes sense. But on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, I think that we have actually reduced no whip mark. It's because we have a timer, and I've learned to match my answers to the timer. All those people who had a chance to say no to the timer because you wanted to be whipped, you could have done so, but we got the timer, and I ain't getting whipped anymore. But the point is, I think that while there are programs that allow non-U.S. citizens who are in the United States legally to join the military and sort of get fast-tracked for citizenship, I don't think it's a blanket program. I think it's actually the number of slots available are limited. And I don't think that there's a correlation between the amount of illegal immigrants are coming in and U.S. Army's recruiting plan.
All right. I don't know what kind of shape they're in, but here's a look at the Ukrainian army or people who are probably about to start serving the Ukrainian army. They're caught by border agents as they're trying to flee the country.
One dude needs a haircut, or is that a dudette?
I don't know. What happens after do they immediately get thrown into the service, or they get beaten up more, or what happens?
Well, my understanding is that first of all, they get the living crap beat out of them. And then they get sent to a recruiting center where they get even more crap beat out of them. They'll get a uniform. They'll get very little training, depending on their attitude. They may be sent to the front with they may not get ammunition till they get to the front. And it's basically you're thrown up in your thing. You're kicked out. You get your old rusty, rifle, and they throw you a couple magazines, maybe a grenade or two, and then they drive away. And now you're in the front lines and you're in survivor mode. What tends to happen is, because you have no clue what's going on, you die very quickly, or you just sit there and cower and pray that when the Russian comes over the top, that he doesn't see the weapon and shoot you, that the Russian gives you a chance to say, I don't want to play this anymore, because they don't give you access to the radio to dial in 140.129 or whatever it is. It's called Volga, and say, I surrender. And you have to be careful, because behind you is a whole bunch of well-fed Azov guys with machine guns and sniper rifles, and they're looking for you to stand up and go, I'm ready to surrender. And they pop you in the back, and you're down and dead. And it's because the next guy, they want to make sure the guy next to you says, oh, damn, I can't surrender, or they'll shoot me. And so your job is just to sit there and hold a position to buy time. You're physically being there requires the Russians now to assault the position, because they can't assume that there's no well-trained people in there. So they're going to assault the position, and that takes time. That eats up a day or two. That gives the Ukrainians chance to bring in more forces, et cetera, make up a thing. But it's horrible. It's horrible. This is why the casualties are so high on the part of Ukraine, because they're just poorly trained people.
It's hard to imagine how it could be any worse than what you just described, really. Let's take another phone call.
The Vishal guy was me. Who was Vishal? Did we have a Vishal question?
Yeah, that's a
familiar. Which question was that? How did I offend
him?
Hello. I don't know, but we got a phone call coming in now.
Should okay.
We? All right. Hey there, you're on with Scott.
Oh, hi. Thank you both. Just a question of liberty. Way back when I was kind of venturing out of physics and studying about history, I heard that the liberty was just a ploy to attack, to blame it on Egypt, because Egypt had a nationalist government, but then it went sour. And following that, there was a threat for Lebanon. If the prime minister, a nationalist one, is elected, they would be nuked, and they gave the message to Premier Khrushchev. I don't understand why the Soviet Union needed to be informed about it, but that's something that way back when I was studying it, just out of curiosity, nothing else. I appreciate your comment. Thank you so much. I also got the coin last night. It's good. I like it.
All right. You're all set. Life is good. Be well.
Well, I'll tell you what. What we're going to find out Friday night is, first of all, the Liberty crew, these were select, hand-picked Americans of the highest intelligence, the highest patriotism, the highest loyalty. They were on a ship where, just to be on the ship, you had to be the most trusted person in the United States, to have the clearances they had, to be doing the work that they were doing. You know, these are not, you know, throwaway Americans. These are the best of the best, the elite of the elite, the most patriotic of patriots you can possibly get, who have been through every vetting process in the world. When you say USS Liberty, people are like, oh, there was those guys that, you know, they have a chip on their shoulder, and there's a, well, hell yeah, they were attacked. Over 34, 37 of them were killed.
I think it was 34.
Their commander got a Medal of Honor. Silver stars were handed out like candy, not because they didn't earn it, but because they deserved it. Purple Hearts, everybody, Bronze Stars. And we're talking about the best combat awards in a ship that wasn't supposed to be in combat. And check it out. We weren't at war anywhere in the Middle East at that time. So why are we handing out Medal of Honor, Silver Stars, and Bronze Stars, and Purple Hearts to this ship? Because they got attacked, brutally attacked, and they performed heroically. But the thing about smart people is they're loyal. They were compelled not to ask any questions because they didn't want to reveal anything. But these are smart people, and they ask questions. And smart people demand legitimate answers. So when we talk to Mr. Turner, right?
Turney, T-O-U-R-N-E-Y, Phil Turney.
On Friday night, I can guarantee you that he has dug into this story, and he's a smart guy. And they have the answers as to what was going on. I don't see them out there asking questions. The only question anyone asks is, why were they betrayed, and why has America turned their back on them? That's the question. Why has America turned their back collectively on the most patriotic people? And one of the answers is Israel. We've allowed Israel to disgrace the service of these heroic men who gave their lives doing a job that they're not allowed to talk about. And that's one of the problems. But he'll answer those questions, because I don't think the Liberty crew has allowed any stone left unturned on this one. They've examined everything, and I bet you they have the answers to all the questions anybody might have about what really was going on.
Yeah, they've been seeking justice for a very long time, so I'm sure Phil has plenty to say. And I had a nice chat with him yesterday, and he's very articulate, very nice man, so I'm really looking forward to Friday night's show. Yeah. Odysseus Panopoulos, who apparently has two homes, Brussels and Greece. Medvedev has said that conventional direct conflict with NATO will be handled as a nuclear war immediately. Does this mean that all large cities in NATO countries and Russia will be targeted with nukes? What would China and the rest of the nuclear powers do?
Well, first of all, let's remember that Medvedev is a deputy chairman of the National Security Council, but he's not the chairman. The chairman's name is Putin, and Putin is also the president, who's the commander in chief. And if Russia goes to war, the briefcase is opened up in front of Putin, not Medvedev. And so Medvedev can talk, and I'm sure that he speaks from experience, but I would imagine that there will be a phase, depending on how the attack takes place, that will allow the situation to develop. And what I mean by that is, let's say, Lithuania did something stupid and made a move on Kaliningrad to try and blockade it. There might be a conventional military interaction there, because Russia says we have to do something. Russia's first response isn't going to be the second a Lithuanian fires a bullet over the head is, hit London, hit Paris, hit Brussels. I think they're going to destroy the Lithuanians. Now, if NATO responds by launching an attack out of Finland towards St. Petersburg, and Poland making a move, towards Minsk, I think Russia might wait and see how their conventional forces develop. Now, if the West starts to launch deep strikes and start to impact strategic capability, Russia won't wait anymore. And boom, they'll kill everything at that point in time. They'll just, because Russia's not going to play the game of graduated response, because if you do that, you allow the enemy through the OODA loop, keep it in mind, it applies to everything. The enemy will get inside your decision-making cycle. Next thing you know, the Russians are responding to NATO initiatives and they get beat. So what Russia will do at some point in time is just say, screw it, we're going to out-OODA you, launch everything. Respond to that, bitches, and the world ends and it's all over. But they will target every NATO city and every American city that's in their targeting plan. The United States used to have a strategic response that just assumed that if we went to general nuclear war, we have to nuke everybody. So even though, let's say, a conflict started between us and Russia, we wouldn't want China to emerge, because even though we plan on winning that war, we know we'll have diminished capacity. We don't want China to have superior capacity. So our job is to eliminate all potential threats. So we nuke everybody to make sure that in a post-nuclear world, America's retained capabilities still are superior to all else. I don't know if that's still part of our nuclear strategy. It seems to me that the sick people in Washington, D.C. would sustain that sick thinking because they still believe in winnable nuclear war.
All right, the Yelena mystery is solved. Before I tell you why she didn't join us today, I want to ask you a general question. Do you think she has a good excuse, a great excuse, or a bad excuse?
I have the highest respect for Yelena as a professional and somebody who cares deeply about everything she does. So I think that her excuse will be great because it'll be honest, it'll be real, and it'll be relevant.
It is a great excuse. Can you imagine what it is?
Power outage in Norway.
No. She didn't know that we are now in daylight savings time.
My God, Yelena, all I had to do is pick up the phone, spring forward, fall back. You, Yelena, you and 90% of America are on the same page, because I'm still running to people going, yeah, what the hell is wrong with this?
You know, actually, I think for the first time ever, I didn't know that the clock changed this weekend. And so I wake up and I go to my computer and it said 11 o'clock on my computer. It said 10 o'clock on my phone, and on my clock on the wall, it said 9 o'clock. So I'm like, well, I guess the time changed, but why is it three different times instead
of two? Which direction did it go?
Yeah.
Well, so, I don't know. Go ahead.
It turns out that my computer changed automatically, but it changed incorrectly. So that's why it was three different times. Yeah. Wow. No, the right direction, but 2 hours instead of 1 hour, which is weird. My phone changed automatically and it was correct. And my clock on the wall, I have to change manually. So,
let me just tell you how pathetic I am as a human being. Yeah. A week ago, my clock in my car was 1 hour ahead because I don't know how to change the clock in my car. I've spent too much time pushing buttons and the wrong things are happening. So I just decided, screw it. I'm just going to assume that the clock is 1 hour ahead. And then when we sprang forward, the clock on my car was correct, but my little stupid brain didn't work. So I'm driving around and I'm supposed to pick Marina up at a very specific time. And I'm driving around going, I got an hour, but no, the clock. So Yelena, you're not the only one.
Right. These cars have so many controls on them that it's impossible to learn them all. I somehow managed to figure out how to change the clock on my car, so I'm very proud of myself.
I couldn't figure out how to get are smart, and they actually put the right time on it. Thank goodness, or else I'd be running around who knows what.
I couldn't figure out how to assemble my desk, though. I had to hire a handyman to do that, but anyway. Let's do a couple more questions. Tommy in Denmark, it feels like the West, particularly the EU, is gearing up for a prolonged conflict where they're not exactly coming out on top, while the US and the military-industrial complex are reaping some benefits. So what's the end game here for the West?
Well, when you say gearing up for a prolonged conflict where they're not exactly coming out on top, you know, the way that's written, it implies that they know that they're not going to come out on top. And I don't agree with that. I mean, they know that they're not coming out on top. So they're not gearing up for this. I think they're in a trap. I mean, it's like me going out swimming and getting caught up in an undertow. And people can watch me and say, Scott appears to be in the water and he's gearing up to float off to that distant spot in the horizon. Nope, I got in the water to go over here, but I got sucked away by the undertow and I'm disappearing. This happens a lot in Hawaii. It happened to me at least twice in Hawaii where I got sucked out into the Molokai Strait and some dude with a surfboard had to come out and save me. But different story. But the point is, I think Europe right now is just in a situation where it's out of control, literally out of control. They don't know what's happened to them. They were led to believe by the United States that the U.S. would be there. And therefore, like all compliant little subservient poodle nations, they just assumed that the master knows best. It's like when I take my dogs for a walk, I put them in the car and they're just assuming that master knows how to drive me. Master's going to get me to the park. Master's going to let me run around. They don't realize that anywhere between there and there, I could screw up, get in an accident, bad things could happen. They just trust that I'm going to do it right. The last thing they expect is I'm going to put them in the car, head to the park, park my car, open the door, and me run away and leave them in the car. That's what's happened to Europe. They got in a car driven by Victoria Nuland, and she said, we're going to the park. And Europe's like, yay, we're going to the park. We're going to the park. And Victoria Nuland got halfway to the park and was told, got the phone call from whoever her master is, and pulled off, put it in park, and left. And the European puppies are in the car going, why aren't we going to the park? Why aren't we going to the park? Because America doesn't want to go to the park anymore. And Europe isn't mature enough or strong enough or competent enough to do anything about it. And so you have the French that are hanging out there going, we're going to go into Ukraine unilaterally. No, you're not. The Poles, we're going to support that. No, you're not. The Baltic part, no, you're not. Europe isn't going to do anything because Europe can't do anything because Europe is pathetic. They're collapsing economically, they're dysfunctional politically, and they're powerless militarily. And without America, they amount to nothing. So right now, Europe's just in a bad spot. And what Europe needs to do is come together and start looking out for Europe first and stop being, you know, compelled to, you know, exist, you know, based upon the whim of a master that has shown a proclivity to run away from the car when they're supposed to be taking them to the park.
All right, let's do one more question. Kenneth in Norway, why does the U.S. Navy still invest in carrier groups when modern warfare has shown that the future of warfare is missiles, drones, etc.? And if a missile sinks a carrier, that's a lot of war power going down.
Yeah, U.S. Navy is going to invest in carrier groups until we lose three or four carrier groups in the next war. And then the U.S. Navy is going to wake up and say carrier groups are not a viable means of power projection. And we'll move away. But it's legacy. It's the same thing. Look at the Marine Corps, you know, World War II. We piled Marines onto ships, and then we pulled the ships up next to an island, and we all came out of the boat, and we went around in circles till we all lined up, and then we went in, and we went across the beach. And so look at the amphibious ships. We had, you know, amphibious ships that were designed to do the exact same things. Yes, we upgraded it. We had helicopters and we had LCACs and all that, but it's still, the bottom line is Marines park offshore, get off, disembark, move in and move inland. And finally, we had two commandants ago, we had a commandant came in and said, that's pretty stupid. They got missiles that will sink our ships. Why are we going to put all our Marines in one, you know, one ship? We're going to break it up. And so he's starting to think about how the Marine Corps can operate in this new reality. But the Navy hasn't gone there because the carrier is the heart of the Navy. That's how everybody gets promoted. You want to command a carrier. You want to command the air wing. You want to command a carrier battle group, the ultimate expression of American military power projection, et cetera. And plus, defense industry now is all geared around the carrier. We're talking billions of dollars to go into making everything about an aircraft carrier. A lot of people make money. So if one day one of these admirals woke up and said, I don't think carriers are the way to go, you'd have everybody in Congress who makes money off the carrier go, no, we're sticking with carriers. And unfortunately, we're going to stick with carriers until, like I said, three or four of them go down, about, you know, 30,000 people die with them. And then finally, somebody will say, oh, maybe we should look at a new way of projecting power that doesn't involve putting all our eggs in one basket.
Within the next few hours, there'll be a new Substack post, Scott Ritter and the Russian Path of Redemption, Part 3, The Bittersweet Birth of New Russia. Check that out at scottritterextra.com. And while you're there, if you haven't already subscribed, please do so. And what's wrong with you for not subscribing already?
Now, are we doing a coin or a shirt giveaway today? Or
Not today. I think we might have done that enough, but we can talk about that. In any case, I'm not prepared to do it. So that's that. But thanks to our beloved audience. And thanks to Yelena for caring. She was very apologetic in the message she sent to me on Telegram. Don't you worry about it, Yelena, if you're watching. I understand. In fact, let's say it was my fault for assuming that you know.
Failing to inform.
Exactly. Well, I mean, why should I assume that the whole world knows about our wacky time thing? Now, one of the comments asked, what is daylight savings time? Well, in the spring, the clock goes ahead 1 hour so that it gets dark later in the day or in the evening than it otherwise would. That's what it's all about. Friday night filter.
So my wife doesn't have to come home in the dark. That's the idea of daylight savings time.
Yeah. But I guess the trade-off is it's dark in the morning instead. So
yes, there is that too.
I'd rather have it light in the evening, but that's because I don't get up early. But the Ritters get up early, right?
Ritter gets up early. Mrs. Ritter, she changed certain aspects of her job. She used to have to get up at 4:30 in the morning to be at work by 5:45. But now she doesn't have to go to work until 9. But I, on the other hand, continue to have to get up at very early hours. And so
you have to, because the dog wakes you, or because of
that. And again, because of the demands of my demanding work schedule, I have to get up and produce certain products in the morning for one employer and then be ready to do other things at another time for another employer and make sure that I leave enough time for the employer that I'm talking to right now. So yeah, no, I have to, I'm a very busy guy.
I just realized my new setup, I think, needs some adjustment. I see the reflection of the lights in my glasses. We can't have that. I'm going to work on that. You see that? It's kind of reflecting the light.
I see that. I just assume that you have a lot of monitors in front of you and you're a very important man.
Well, that's both correct, but I still should be able to do it without the reflection showing. All right. So join us on Friday night for Ask the Inspector. Phil Turney, who is the president of the USS Liberty Veterans Association, will be here and he'll tell us all about their plight. And as long as he's up for it, we can take some questions from the audience as well. And then next Tuesday, we'll be back with the lightning round of Ask the Inspector for 1 hour. Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less, as he did today. Thank you very much, Scott. Thanks to our beloved audience.
Next Tuesday, we won't be doing the show.
Oh, is that next Tuesday? Oh, you're right.
Next Tuesday, yeah. Because I will be traveling.
All right.
And so will Jeff. We might even be traveling together.
We might. There's a rumor to that effect. So, all right. In any case, we'll see you on Friday night. Take care, everybody.